I'm sorry that I may be disappointing a number of you. First of all, because I see at least one face here of somebody who's heard exactly the same talk that I'm going to give today already. Second, because most of you probably have been expecting to hear about something else, but I thought since these results are brand new, you'd be interested to hear about them. Even though at first glance they don't deal with concentration phenomena or vortex dynamics. But they deal with something evolving in time, and that's wave maps. Moreover, I'll be using transparencies, and I know that this is not usually appreciated, but I'll be using the blackboard as a backup system, for instance, to write down important things that otherwise I would forget. And so I think I should now start with my talk. Well, you probably don't all know what a wave map is, so here on this slide I've prepared some short introduction to the concept of wave maps. And maybe I can lower this so that I can point on the screen. So this is just the standard M plus one dimensional Minkowski space, and coordinates are denoted with time t and spatial x coordinates, and the pair is denoted as z, and also with indices alpha from 0 up to m as x alpha, the M plus one tuple x alpha. And then we're looking at maps U from the Minkowski space to a compact, smooth Riemannian target manifold without boundary. And to make things simple, we can always assume that this target manifold is isometrically embedded in Rn by the Nash embedding theorem. Okay, yeah, thanks. All right, so then I can move that a little bit further up. But it has the disadvantage that you'll have to choose between the transparency and maybe what I'm doing. All right, so we're looking at maps U from the Minkowski space to this target manifold. And the space-time derivative of U is given by the time differential U sub t and the spatial derivatives Nabla of U, and this is also an M plus 1 tuple of vectors d alpha U with alpha ranging from 0 to m. And we use the standard Minkowski metric to raise and lower indices like this. And then we have the Lagrangian. This is this is just like the standard Dirichlet density whose critical points describe harmonic functions or more generally harmonic maps. But now, since we're using the Minkowski metric, this is actually the square of the spatial derivatives minus the square of the time derivative. And then stationary points of this Lagrangian will correspond to solutions of some wave equation. So this is the wave operator. It's given as UTT, second time derivative, minus Laplacian of U. And, all right. So if we did not have such a geometric target constraint, then stationary points of this Lagrangian would just satisfy the linear wave equation, box of U equals zero. But now we have the target constraint, so we may only allow variations of this Lagrangian density that infinitesimally respect the target constraint. So the stationarity condition is that box of U is a vector which is everywhere orthogonal to the tangent space at U. And I think here I also try to visualize this. So box of U for this vector-valued function is just box of each of the components, the vector of box of U1 through box of UN, and this vector should be orthogonal to the tangent space at any point U of Z of N. Now, this looks a bit awkward. It is a differential relation, but you can actually write down a pointwise quasi-linear hyperbolic system for this. For instance, if the target manifold is the sphere, it's very easy to compute that box of U is actually given by U times the Lagrangian density, gradient U squared minus the time derivative, and in general, it's given by the second fundamental form of the target manifold where we plug in the lower alpha and the upper alpha of U. So we can now go back to this slide, and I just recalled what I had on the other one up here. And then since this is a hyperbolic system of differential equations, it makes sense to study the initial value problem for initial data in a certain Sobolev space. And it's clear that the data U naught for the function U itself should just be a map from Rm to the target manifold N. However, for the initial data for the time derivative, which I call U1, then you require that U1 at every point x should be a tangent vector. So the pair U0, U1 is actually a map into the tangent bundle. And the first component, U0, should have Sobolev regularity HS. The second component, U1, corresponds to a derivative, so there is one less differentiability required, and that explains this notation. Now, let's analyze the regularity assumption on the data a little bit. And again, I've got some backup. First of all, there's a simple a priori estimate when S is equal to 1, which can be recovered from this simple geometric relation. So using this geometric structure of the wave map system, you immediately deduce a conservation law. Namely, when you multiply box of U with the tangent vector UT, you get 0. And on the other hand, you get that this is the total time derivative of the total kinetic energy squared over 2 minus the divergence of the so-called momentum vector. Now, suppose that the derivative has spatially compact support, then when you integrate over Rm, this term here will drop out, and you get the time derivative of this energy integral of the L2 norm of d of u. This energy will be a constant. It is given simply by the energy of the initial data. So that's an a priori estimate when S here, this S is equal to 1. And it's the only a priori estimate that's known. On the other hand, a dimensional analysis tells you which numbers S here naturally can appear. So observe that when U is a solution, after scaling time and space coordinates with a positive number R, you obtain another solution UR of the wave map system, just given by this identity. And then if you compute the S energy norm, that is the L2 norm of dS of UR, from the chain rule you get R to the 2S, and then from the change of variables formula you get R to the minus M as a factor in front of this integral. And you see that this norm here stays invariant under the scale change if 2S equals M, that is whenever S equals M over 2, which is then the critical regularity for this problem. Now, what are the results that you can prove on local well-posedness for the initial value problem? First of all, by classical methods, it's easy to show that you have a local solution whenever S is larger than M over 2 plus 1. This is very easy to see because in that case, the space HS embeds into C1. So you have an L infinity a priori bound for the space-time derivatives, and then the right-hand side there can be treated just like a linear non-linearity. What is this?
Somebody smoking in the background.
I see, yeah. Yeah, but it's not the fire alarm.
No.
Okay.
It's going to be 50 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So, with this choice of S, you're in the realm of classical regularity, and energy estimates give you local world postness. Now, over the years, many people have worked on this problem, starting with Gu Chao Hao, Ginibre Velo, and I won't give you all the history, only give you the most recent results, referring to the title here. And one of the results that I will refer to is this result of Kleinermann-Makedon and Kleinermann-Selberg. They improved, in a series of papers, they improved the regularity requirement from this classical result down to almost the critical regularity that one needs. So S strictly larger than M over 2, that's the best result that was known until, say, 1999. And then last year, all of a sudden, tremendous progress was made. Terence Tao, in September of 2000, showed that when the target manifold is the sphere, and the dimension, the spatial dimension, is at least 5, the problem is locally well posed for small data. That was September 2000. And then maybe October 2000, Kleinermann and Rodnyansky noticed that Tao's proof also works when there's an arbitrary target manifold, which simultaneously also Tao observed, and he wrote a second paper in November 2000 giving the general result using his method. And then in February 2001, Terence Tao also was able to deal with the low-dimensional cases for the critical regularity, however, only when the target manifold is the sphere. So far, for the low-dimensional cases, this restriction still stays. And the result is that one obtains global existence and uniqueness for small data. For small data in the critical norm. The method is quite involved. It uses very delicate and subtle methods from harmonic analysis. However, its core ingredient is the use of the so-called Strichard's estimates. The Strichard's estimate in this work turns out to be the fundamental linear estimate that is needed, like the Calderon-Zygmund estimate for elliptic equations. The Strichard's estimate is the fundamental linear estimate for the wave map system. For a long time, this was sort of unknown, and some people even doubted that the Strichard's estimate would suffice to deal with the wave map problem. But by this work of Terence Tao, it is now clear that the Strichard's estimate actually is all that is needed, at least if you forget about the difficulty with generalizing this result to arbitrary target manifolds. However, next to the Strichard's estimate, there is an enormous technical machine involving dyadic decomposition and microlocal renormalization. And the paper of February 2001 actually is close to 90 pages. And because of this, some people thought that it might also be useful to have a simpler proof. And with Jalal Shattar, we worked on this. And in fact, we obtained a proof that, besides the Strichard estimate, uses only very elementary estimates in physical space. And moreover, this result extends not only to the dimensions 5 and larger, but it extends to dimension m equal 4 for an arbitrary target manifold. And moreover, this target can be a target manifold only of bounded curvature, need not be compact. All we require that is that it is complete, smooth, without boundary, and that the curvature operator and the second fundamental form, they are uniformly bounded with uniformly bounded derivatives. And then, say in the case m equal 4, not treated by the previous results, we get the following result for small data. We have existence and uniqueness of solutions with initial data in H2, and the solutions satisfy this a priori bound. This is just the H2 a priori bound, bounded by a constant times the H2 norm of the initial data. This is only for small data, plus this space-time integrability condition of the derivative du, that is, space and time derivatives of u. So this is one result. That's L8, yes. Yeah, L infinity would be a little bit too much. Actually, in m dimensions, it is L2m. The L2m norm in space is square integrable in time. That's the space-time integrability condition that one gets. So this is one result, and this is the result I want to present today. And tomorrow I'll talk about two more results that I obtained in 2000, discussing special instances of the two-dimensional problem. So just to give you an overview of what is coming forward tomorrow, in two space dimensions, when the target manifold is the sphere, similar to this result of Terence Tao here, in two space dimensions, one actually gets global well-posedness of the problem, even for large initial data, in the radially symmetric case, so when the solution only depends on the distance from the origin. And a similar result in the symmetric setting, in two dimensions, with some other kind of symmetry, so-called co-rotational symmetry. Also, in that case, one gets global existence even for large smooth data when the target manifold is a non-compact surface of revolution. And in the compact case, one gets a characterization of blow-up via bubbling of harmonic maps. So this result then will be more in the spirit of the concentration results that you might have expected today. And I'll talk about Theorem 2 and Theorem 3 tomorrow. Here I'll...
But the new result is only for m equal 4?
No, it also holds for higher dimensions. But the case m equal 4, that's the improvement over these results, aside from the technical improvement, but there is also, as far as the result goes, decisive improvement over the previous results, so I'll concentrate on that case.
So in theorem, say the bubble is always on?
Yes, the bubble always forms at x equals 0. Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't show you the whole... well, maybe I can. Yeah. So, all right. So, let's give you let's try to give you a flavor of the proof of Theorem 1, which, as I said, is actually quite simple. Let me show you how easy it is to obtain uniqueness from this space-time integrability condition here that we get sort of as an extra condition from the existence theory. So here, We take two solutions, U and V, of the wave map system with the same Cauchy data and then study the difference W, U minus V. Then for W, we have this wave equation, box of W, well, that's box of U, A of U, D alpha U, D upper alpha U. Minus A of V, the upper alpha V, and so on. So, simple algebra allows you to separate this difference in this form. So here's the difference of the coefficient in the second fundamental form, and here we have exhibited the difference in the differentials. And then, just as I showed you before, we can derive an energy inequality now for W just by multiplying box of W with the time derivative and integrating in X. This should be an M. Then we get the time derivative of the L2 norm of dW. And because here we have two terms, this is given by two terms. And the first one is very easy to estimate. Let me show you how you can estimate this first term. So that's just the product of this term with WT. And because we assume that N has bounded curvature, this difference is just bounded by a constant times the modulus of W. This obviously is bounded by the norm of du squared, and WT is bounded by dW. So we arrive at this. And then we use Hölder's inequality, where we estimate du squared in L4, this in L2, and then this in L4. And that gives us this bound. And now comes the assumption 3, the space-time integrability hypothesis on the du, which allows to estimate this in L1 in time. W in L4 by Sobolev's embedding theorem can be bounded by dW in L2. So this term here is okay. If we only had the first term, then we now get a differential inequality for the L2 norm of W from which uniqueness would follow. The second term is a little bit more delicate. But here we just use the geometric structure again, what I call the geometric structure, which is nothing but this orthogonality. A of U is orthogonal to the tangent space, in particular A of U dotted with UT vanishes, and similar A of V times VT vanishes. So then let's just consider the one of the terms here on this slide. Let's just consider the term with a d alpha u. With a d alpha u. And the d alpha v, of course, can be treated similarly. Then WT is this difference. And because here the AV is orthogonal to VT, we can cancel the VT. This drops out. And then in the next step, we only have the UT left. We can insert A of U here. And in this way, we again obtain the difference A of V minus A of U as we had before. And then the remainder of the proof is just the same. So the second term, using this geometric structure, can be estimated just the same as the first. And then we arrive at this differential inequality, and since this term is in L1 in time, we get uniqueness. And for the regularity, we can actually use a similar argument. Just think of U and V as being the map U, and V being a spatial translate of U. So you take an infinitesimal translation of the coordinates, and then the estimate for dW will actually give you an estimate for the energy of a difference quotient. So that's uniqueness and regularity. What about existence? Existence, of course, is the hard part because this was so simple. In fact, it suffices to prove a priori bounds for smooth solutions. And here we use the fact that H2 cross H1 is sort of a limit case. In four-space dimensions, H2 barely misses H2 functions barely fail to be continuous. So you barely miss being able to localize things in the target space. And however, still, smooth functions turn out to be dense in the space H2, and therefore you can approximate the given data by smooth data and then look at local smooth solutions. And if then you have a priori bounds for such solutions, you can pass to the limit and obtain the result for the general case. All right, so what is the setup? Again, I'd like to simplify a little bit and not only consider isometrically embedded target manifolds, but in fact, now let's look at a target surface, a Riemann surface, with a frame E bar, a frame E bar for its tangent space. This can always be achieved. There is a construction by Christodoulou, Tavildar-Zadeh, and Elin. Elin for the case of stationary harmonic maps, where they show that in the wave map problem, you can always go to a larger manifold, N tilde, which has a parallelizable tangent bundle. And there you can always choose such a frame field E bar. And when N is a Riemann surface, then the frame actually can be thought of as E bar and the rotated vector I times E bar, where I is just the rotation given by the complex square root of minus 1. All right, then from such a frame field E bar, by composition with the map U, you can then obtain a frame E along the map U. So this E of Z then will be a tangent vector field at the point U of Z, at the point U of Z on the target manifold N. And moreover, you may freely rotate this frame by some complex unit, which I've written as E to the I phi. So there is a U1 gauge freedom acting on this choice of frame. Okay, assume now we have made such a choice, then we can express the differential d of u as a complex-valued one-form q times e. So I'm thinking now as du as a differential, a vector-valued differential with components d alpha of u, and q then is a one-form with complex coefficients q alpha on our Minkowski space. So that's the expression for the derivative of u in the frame. And we also have an expression for the derivative of the frame itself. Now, of course, we're only looking at the covariant derivative. That is, we project everything back down into the tangent space. Then dE will be a multiple of IE, and this multiple will be denoted by the real function A. So now A is a real-valued one-form with coefficients, component functions A alpha. And we have equations for Q and for this connection one-form A. First of all, let's look at a second derivative of u. So d beta of u now is a tangent vector field. Second derivative then can be obtained by covariant differentiation. We have expressed d beta of u as q beta times e. So when the covariant derivative hits the q beta, we get simply the standard derivative, d alpha of q beta. When it hits the e, we get the covariant derivative of e, and so we get this expression. And it's very convenient to summarize, to combine these two terms, and denote this as the covariant derivative of the one-form q beta. And with this notation, we then obtain the following two equations. First of all, the wave map system in covariant notation can be written as this. So the projection into the tangent space of a box of U should vanish. That is this condition. And with that notation, we just obtain the equation d upper alpha q alpha equals 0. And then, since second derivatives on a function commute, we also obtain this condition for the curl of q. And from these two equations, we can then derive a wave equation for q. So let's look at the covariant box operator, the upper alpha, the lower alpha acting on q. First, we commute these indices here using this relation. So we have this. And then we commute the alpha and the beta here. But now we are commuting covariant differentials, so a curvature term will appear acting on q alpha. And after that, we have the beta acting on d alpha q alpha, but this is zero by the wave map equation. So we're only left with this term on the right-hand side, and maybe now I will use the blackboard to write, to make a note of this. So this is equation number 4. So it's a very simple equation that we deduce for this one-form q. Now, I said we also need an equation for the connection A. In general, of course, this will be an SOK connection. Here we have a U1 connection. And the equation can be obtained again by looking at the curvature. So here, I think I'm giving away too much already. So let's look at this difference of second covariant derivative of the frame. So I've written down d beta of a, d beta of e over here. So here's the I, and there's a beta times e. And similarly for the other term. When the alpha hits the a alpha, we just get the standard derivative. And from that other term, we get this guy. And when the d alpha hits the e, we get a term that cancels with a similar term from this. So we only have that term arising as the commutator of the alpha d beta acting on e. And the commutator, on the other hand, is given by the curvature again. So that's one equation that we'll need for the curl of the connection form. Well, and the curvature, I should mention, is of course the curvature of the pullback connection. So it is obtained by plugging into the curvature of n, by plugging in d alpha of u, d beta of u. And of course also the coefficient functions of the curvature are evaluated along the map u. All right. The second equation for the connection form are, in a way, arbitrary. Here we can now use the gauge freedom and make a choice of gauge to obtain a condition for the divergence. And the standard gauge is the so-called Coulomb gauge, where we just require that the sum dj of aj should be 0, where j ranges from 1 to 4. So that's the spatial divergence, if you want, of the connection that should vanish. Then from this equation, we now get an elliptic differential equation for the coefficient functions a beta at any fixed time. The Laplacian acting on a beta, just the second spatial derivative squared acting on a beta, this can be obtained as follows. First of all, we exchange beta and j using the identity for the curl of a up there. That gives us the fj beta. And then, so now we've exchanged here, and then we can exchange these two. Remember, aj is just a real-valued function, so we can now exchange these two and get zero because of the gauge condition. So we have this elliptic equation. Laplacian of a beta is equal dj fj beta, and we can simply solve by inverting the Laplacian by taking the convolution product with the Green's function. The Green's function in four space dimensions is a multiple of 1 over x squared, and then we can throw this differential dj onto the Green's function, and we get a convolution by gj, a multiple of xj over x to the 4. So that's the second equation that we will now need to evaluate this expression. So what we would like to do is we would like to use the Strichert's estimate on the wave equation 4. If here, instead of the covariant wave operator, we had the standard wave operator, we could now use the Strichert's estimate and derive certain LP bounds for Q beta in terms of the right-hand side. But we do not have a standard wave equation. We have a covariant wave equation. And so things become a little bit more complicated, but not too much, as you'll see. So first of all, the Strichert's estimate that we want to use, this is one of the so-called endpoint estimates. The choice of exponents here, the time integrability and the space integrability exponent, this is in a way optimal. It's an endpoint Strichert's estimate. There's a scale of estimates, and you can sort of make a choice where in the scale you want to be, and it's always best to be at an endpoint. And this is one of these optimal endpoint estimates. And there is a subtle improvement here, which I'll come back to later, which was observed by Kiel and Tao. Actually, also their proof. We also use their proof for this estimate. I'm sorry? In their paper, they first have an estimate for the W166 norm. And then you use the Sobolev embedding to get into L8. Yeah. But that's just an aside. So we want to use this estimate for this equation, and we have to transform the covariant wave operator into the standard one. Now, the covariant derivative is gone now, but I think you can easily convince yourself that this here... Maybe when you compute the product of two such operators, there's a differential falling on A alpha. There's A alpha times one differential of this, and there's A alpha squared times this. And actually, the term which is the most difficult to handle is the term A alpha times a differential. A alpha times a differential on Q beta. Why is this the most difficult? Well, later on, you only have the choice of estimating a box of U in L2 in space. So when you estimate this term in L2 in space, you already need the L2 norm of dQ that you have on the left-hand side. You cannot use an exponent greater than 2 because 2 is the most that you can bound by the Strichert's inequality. And it's an endpoint estimate, so you cannot get any better. Here you have no differential of Q, just Q. So this estimate does not help you very much at this stage. So this is the most difficult term because when you estimate this term in L2, you need to estimate the alpha Q beta in L2, and therefore you need to estimate A alpha in L infinity. So A alpha in L infinity. You can only hope to be able to estimate A alpha in L infinity using this identity here, where F is bounded by du squared, and du is nothing but Q. Okay, so this is what I wrote down here. The L1 in time, L2 in space estimate for box of Q can only proceed like this. For that term, you need this, and that can only use L1 in time, L infinity in X estimates for A, because here you cannot go above 2 in X. All right, so how does one estimate A in L infinity? Well, it's a convolution product. And this guy here is in an LP space, and this guy here is in an LP space. Let's look what these spaces are if they match. So, very roughly, we can estimate this by 1 over x cubed. Then we estimate f by du squared. So du by the upper estimate is in L4. This 1 over x cubed is almost in L4 thirds, well, but it's only weakly in L4 thirds. And that is the so-called Lorentz space L4 thirds, infinity. That's weak L4 thirds. And this is now where we need the red 2 coming in. That's the Lorentz exponent. The scale of Lorentz spaces is a refinement of the scale of LP spaces, and the space L8,2 is a smaller space than L8. And when you look at du squared, which is the same as q squared, from that estimate above, you can estimate this in the Lorentz space L4,1. And now it turns out this Lorentz space is the dual of that. So by duality, you can bound the product, the convolution product, by du in L8,2 squared. And then at this stage, the estimate closes. So if this term here is, if the energy of the initial data is sufficiently small, you can get an a priori bound and prove existence. Well, I think that's all for today. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.